Thriller's a great way to get into this next level of the conversation about the undead, in this case, about do we want them coming back? Some people say yes, and that we feel a need to do that. We'll get into that coming up in just a second. You can also link up to Doug Clegg's work through our website at coasttocoastam.com. And I had a great time with Max Brooks. I kind of broke character a little bit with him toward the end. I mean, we have been kind of rolling strong, and then I just kind of felt like, oh, I better step out of this and get to know Max a little bit and talk a little bit about the work. Part of me wanted to take it all the way through to the end, but I'm mindful of the fact that a couple of weeks ago I made a joke on Coast to Coast about when the Pope had made five new saints. And I had said that it was surprising to see that number five was President Obama, in light of the fact that he's neither Catholic nor dead. And so much email of people who believed that. And I felt bad. Some people had phoned their friends to tell them either what they thought of as being really good news or really horrible news, depending. And several angry emails of people saying that. Can't believe I would pull such a hoax like that. And I wasn't trying to pull a hoax. I was just making a little comment about the Nobel Peace Prize. And one person even went so much as to post a response, kind of this big so there response to my blog last week by listing the actual names of the people who'd been canonized to straighten me out. I encourage you to always send responses to the blog. Happy to have you do that. In this case, however, I wasn't attempting to convince people that President Obama had been canonized. I'm sorry you missed the satire of that. And I hope that we didn't scare anybody too badly with the zombie war conversation. As it is, anytime you're talking about the undead, it can, it right away, some people just can't handle the conversation. And I see that some of that reflected in this new movie, Paranormal Activity. I saw it today. It's this huge box office hit. It's been showing at midnight at selected theaters, packed houses. And I'm not going to get into the movie one way or another in terms of, talking about it or what goes on in it, except to say that go see it before it's overly hyped. Same thing with Zombieland. Don't let anybody tell you the fun secrets of Zombieland. Just go see it if you enjoy that type of a movie. And if you want to see more on that, you can go to my blog at coasttocoastam.com. I talk a little bit more about it there and put up some fun links. But I do want to talk to you about just the general idea of hauntings and the undead. And that viewed this time through the perspective of Douglas Clegg. He's a New York Times bestselling author of The Priest of Blood, Afterlife, and The Hour Before Dark, among other novels and collections. We'll tell you more about that and get his perspective on why we need horror, and how he tells a good horror story next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Douglas Clegg, it appears as though we have a mutual friend in Dean Koontz.
Oh, Dean's a great guy.
He put a nice blurb on your last book or just on your website.
It's actually a general blurb, actually, for some of my fiction that he's read.
That's good. A
So it's
general
really,
blurb.
yeah, it's really great. He's a wonderful man, very supportive of writers, great writer.
I never thought to ask him for a general blurb. I could
I didn't
have.
ask him for that. It was specific at the time, but he gave me a very nice blurb about the story, so that's always good.
No, I want a blurb now from him too. I'm gonna get Dean to give me a
Oh,
blurb
he's going to be inundated.
I
Everyone
gotta
I
put
talk to.
I want a general blurb from Dean Koontz. I'm gonna put it on my business card or
But
something
every
like
time, see, if you get it, then mine is worth less.
that. Well, it's just gonna have to be. The new book is a tale of the supernatural, Isis. Douglas Clegg is an award-winning horror writer. You probably didn't catch any of the show before you came
I just
on.
listened to it. Are you kidding?
Did you? Was that fun with Max Brooks talking about the zombie wars?
Yeah, except, let me tell you, my take on zombies is, see, I know I would lose to a zombie. I wouldn't even fight him. I'd say, okay, take me now. And then when I became a zombie, actually before it, I'd look around to see whose brains I'd want.
Oh, really? So you
So,
kind of
like,
like mark them in advance?
Well, and I want to go for the smart people because I kind of think a zombie might absorb the smart brains better. So I'm like, I want Herta Mueller, who just won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
So you're coming after Herta Mueller. You're gonna, that's yeah. your, okay, that's your, you're a zombie with a goal. You're
really, exactly.
And upwardly torment, mobile zombie.
For torment, I'd go for Bernie Madoff. For although not that he had my money, but yeah. And then I'm thinking John or Kate. I wouldn't go for plus eight, but a John or Kate, which has a better brain? Who, which, if you had a choice as a zombie in a room, John or Kate?
Well, if it's possible that smart people would help you evolve, aren't you fearful that eating John or Kate would dumb you down a little bit?
Suddenly, I'd be like Lucy, the leaky sound. You know, suddenly, I'd actually devolve backwards in time.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that if I were you. I would let them go. I'd let them pass for the time being.
So, you know, by the way, and I read your Saint blog, and I really think there were some missed saints, like the guy who invented chewing gum. I think that should be a saint.
But not the one thing I was... Go ahead.
Sorry, the one thing I was shocked at was that, you know, the Father Damien became a saint. And at first I thought, isn't he that kid? But then right. I realized it was a different Damien. So.
Well, you know, it's actually a perfect transition because I thought there's very few movies that have scared me. There's very few even books that get to me. And mostly because I think too often for the purposes of moving a plot along, authors have a tendency to kind of show their cards a little bit about what's coming up. It's hard to write horror well. It's hard to write suspense well. And you're an award-winning horror and suspense writer. How do you honor the convention of horror and at the same time not telegraph the ending?
Gosh, that's a great question because I'm thinking, do I telegraph the ending? I'm not really sure. I think it depends on the story. I mean, there are some stories that, you know, it's interesting. Very few novels have actually scared me in horror, but I enjoy them. Movies, you've got to see this movie, The Children. It's a recent movie on DVD. Scary as crazy.
Okay, I think I actually got a copy of that. Somebody sent that to me, and I haven't looked at it yet. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, you know, essentially, I believe it's a British movie, and it's, you know, it's set, these people are going out for Christmas with their kids, and something happens. I mean, for me to tell to you too much is too much, but essentially, it's a war against their own children.
Right.
And it is tense. I mean, it's not, it's one of those things where there's the genius of it is in the tension. And I think that's what you're talking about, is maintaining that tension is very difficult.
Because you want to tell enough about what's happening that people feel like they're living it, but I think the problem is a lot of writers can't resist, or they I don't know if it's overestimating or underestimating the reader, but somehow they give away so much information that, at least in my case, I'm going to go, I totally know how this is going to end.
You can predict. I mean, the movie The Omen, for instance. You know, you knew Damien, it wasn't going to end well. But the wild card of scary in that was the nanny.
Right.
You know,
there was lots of wild cards in that.
I'm here to protect you with my Rottweilers.
You know, David O. Seltzer, the guy who wrote The Omen, was also the guy that wrote Willy Wonka.
Oh, the movie? Oh, he wrote
the movie.
Interesting. Wow.
The original movie. And in fact, as I understand it, as the legend goes anyway, he used the money he made from being the script doctor on Willy Wonka to take time off to go write The Omen. And he sequestered himself into like a cabin in upstate New York or something, and he wrote The Omen. And I find that, I don't know why that duality intrigues me so much. But
you know, by the way, that's an interesting point, because I think there's a very close connection between, well, first of all, I want to interrupt and just say, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the book, as well as the movie Willy Wonka, they're essentially nightmares. They're nightmares about kids. Like, some of those kids in the book, they don't exactly die, but they kind of go somewhere else.
Oh, I'd say their childhood dies. I mean, their ideology dies. Their belief in the fact that they're somehow immortal, that dies. They become very vulnerable after Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Well, and one kid I think turns into a blueberry. It's been a while since I read the book, but you know, Roald Dahl, who wrote the book, that guy wrote scary stuff. And so I think that there is a connection between the guy who doctored the script of Willy Wonka and then go write The Omen, especially probably having to deal with children in a script in the first one. He's probably like, okay, now I'm going to do one of those kids with a devil child. I'm going to write a
Right. Well, I thought what's interesting is that, you know, he writes his own, in some cases, he writes his own scripture to fit the book. So, I mean, he doesn't, you know, and he's not even, he wasn't even part of a Christian apocalyptic tradition. He just, he realized this scared people. So he wrote a novel that fit what was already scaring people.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I went to college in the South, and I love the South, so this is not a slam to them at all. I love the South. But one of my friends who saw it was like, it's in the Bible. I mean, he believed in the omen because they used biblical passages in it.
Well, or modified biblical passages in it, which is also interesting. And that's a great, I mean, obviously Quentin Tarantino does the same thing in Pulp Fiction. And a lot of people think that that soliloquy from Pulp Fiction is actually in the Bible, and it's not. So, But I think that's where, I mean, but to go back to the omen actually scared me as a story, the omen scared, because I really didn't see where it was going. I really didn't know how it was going to end. And that's a tough thing to pull off. And I think the movie remake was pretty good, but the original was it's sort of like the planets lined up just right, even though the special effects aren't perfect. And it's still just amazingly creepy.
Yeah, the remake, what's interesting is they just did that perfect casting of Mia Farrow as the nanny, where you go, oh, you know, in real life, like, you know her story. And also the fact that she was Rosemary's Baby in that movie. So
right.
You have this sort of, it's like a mythic aura around Mia Farrow for that role, which was a fun idea.
Right.
I think the other thing with it that everyone can relate to, I think the thing with The Omen is everyone can relate to one aspect of that, and that is when they were a little kid being dressed for church, they screamed like heck to get out of going to church.
the monkey scene was really interesting, or the baboon scene in the original Omen, because I think I read later on that Lee Remick, the actress, was really freaking out about it, and she really did not know that it was going to be as bad as it was. Nice. They didn't tell her that they were going to go as and she went. That was an authentic reaction that was captured on film, and I love that. But
I think that was the same with the Cowardly Lion with the flying monkeys. He didn't know.
Right. They didn't tell him. So let me ask you then, I mean, in terms of why do we need horror? What is it that horror does for us, the living, who live in these very nice lives, and generally speaking, those of us who aren't fighting the supernatural at every moment, why do we like to read it? Why do we like to experience it?
I think there are a few reasons. I mean, you know, to me, one of the simplest reasons is it sticks a pin in the balloon of belief or expectations or normal life. It sticks a balloon in that, and there's something about that release of, like, you know, we have these fears in our head, we bottle them up, we don't want to believe them, we don't want to, I mean, I don't know if you do this, Ian, but, you know, there are nights when if I'm alone in the house and I hear the creaking and I can't quite sleep, my mind starts to go, and I start to think, okay, what if someone's out there? If someone's out there, what if I'm just lying here pretending no one's out there because it's my imagination, but in fact someone is out there, and they have, like, a glove puppet, and the glove puppet has, like, a knife. I mean, you know, my mind starts to go like that, and I think everyone has those moments at times, not as specific.
Yeah.
And so I think that what happens is it's a way to stick a pin in that balloon so that you can sort of enjoy the ride because you know it's fictional when you're reading that.
Douglas, I think I was with you right up to glove puppet. I think I was. Thank you.
I had a nightmare about a glove puppet once, so that's why I sort of threw that
a glove line. Puppet with a knife. I have to say that I was thinking, yeah, I can relate to that. No, I can't relate to that.
I don't even want to tell you how that night ended because I was at my sister's place watching it, and she had like a taser or something, as you know, some people do, I guess. And it was by the bed, and let me tell you, I had the dream about the glove puppet, the guy coming through the door with the glove puppet, and I woke up and I couldn't sleep until dawn. I was up with that taser sitting on that bed saying, if anything comes through that door, I may be crazy, but if anything comes through that door, I'm going to get it.
And let's just assume that a taser would work on a glove puppet.
Well, you know, if I can get close enough to...
Does a taser work on the supernatural? That's a really good question.
That is
Would
true,
a taser work on a zombie? Would a zombie care if you were tasering it?
And you have to get close enough to do it.
Yeah.
You have to be really good at it. No, you know, I think it sticks a pin in fear. I also think that a lot of supernatural stories really deal with love and loss. We all lose people we love. I mean, this really is part of life that none of us likes to look at until we absolutely have to. I remember being a certain age, and I want to say about when I was about 25, thinking, I haven't known anyone directly who's died yet. And right. I was sort of thrilled with that because I knew I was relatively innocent in the world still. I knew death existed as an intellectual idea, but no one had. And then, you know, gradually people just started dying that you know, people who die. Accidents happen, life happens. And I think that loss, you know, you really want someone you care for to come back. Sometimes some people you don't want to come back, but some people you really lose and you dream about them and you want to believe. And I've had I'm not a huge believer in ghosts, and yet I've had ghost experiences.
How can you have had ghost experiences and not believe in your own experience?
Well, I think my left hemisphere is at war with my right. I think it's because I don't want to believe on some level someone might ever call nonsense. But one of the experiences I had, very simply, was my folks had a house out in a town called Redlands, California, and I was staying for a while there, and I would have every night I thought this old man in the straw hat was, like, stepping into my room. I'd turn on the light, and nothing was there. Never mentioned it to my parents because I thought I was crazy, as per usual. And then when my parents put the house on the market, they were selling it, a neighbor came over, and the neighbor said, wow, this is a really old farmhouse. I mean, this is a really old house. I bet it has ghosts. And I said, you know, there's this thing that I saw once. And my mother said, oh, the old farmer? And I said, you saw that? And she said, oh, yeah, she saw it twice. We had never discussed it. Nothing ever happened around it. But that's an odd thing to have happened. And it made me think, okay, I don't know what a ghost is. I don't know if it's an echo. I don't know if it's a shared communication between minds. I don't know. Or it's a spirit. But we definitely had that experience.
But now, in compartmentalizing that experience, you said it. Maybe it's just a war between your left brain and your right brain. Okay, that's fine if it was merely an internal struggle. But then, now you've triangulated the guy with the straw hat with your mom.
You know, sometimes when things hit me in the face, I don't see them. Because now that we're talking about it, I've had a couple of experiences, and I've tried to poo-poo it because I don't want to seem like the ghost believer. And then I start to think, well, what is it? It is something.
Sorry. No, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's something I don't understand. No, believe me, I'm on the fence. The idea of belief to me entails a certain amount of I have an absolute whole sense of this. I have a slight belief, I guess I should say.
First of all, I think poo-poo is my least favorite verb most of the time. But I like how you used it. So usually I don't like it, but I like that. And then... But in the sense that you had your mother have an experience, you'd have to. How do you dismiss your own mother having the exact same experience that you were having without any knowledge that she was having it, and her without any knowledge that you?
Well,
were having?
I didn't. But you know, it's sort of like the denial that goes on in families. She and I never mentioned it again. I mean, the funny part is when I think about it, we never mentioned it again, just like so many things in the family. So. But it's true. It's like, you know, denial is the norm in a lot of families. And so I really haven't really explored it. I have some friends who are paranormal investigators in their writing, and I've gone with them on things, and I have experienced things, and I don't know what to make of them yet, I guess.
Well, you know what? Actually, that's a nice way to circle back to where we started at the top of the hour. I saw this movie, Paranormal Activity, today. And I want to tell you a little bit about it, and I want to tell you what I learned from that movie without telling you about what was in it. And I think it speaks to what we're talking about. Douglas Clegg is the author of many short and longer stories of horror fiction. You can link up to him through our website at coasttocoastam.com. And I want to get back to that too, and the elements of the storytelling, because coming up in just a few weeks, we're going to do Ghost to Ghost AM, where people will be able to call in and tell their own ghost experiences. And it reminded me of an email I got last week about something that somebody experienced as a night watchman, which has been giving me the creeps ever since I've been read that email. And then how, you know, we all need to be focused on what we really see and what we really experience next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, if you missed the first half of the show, it was World War Z with Max Brooks. It's worth going back and catching in Streamlink, as is this conversation with Douglas Clegg, a horror fiction writer in his own right. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. We were just talking about the paranormal activity that Douglas has personally experienced. And I'll throw in the paranormal activity that I experienced today, that being the new movie that's out. And what are the lessons learned from that? Next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Paranormal Activity is a new movie that just went into wider distribution. I wrote a little bit about it on the blog at coasttocoastam.com, but not much because I don't want to give too much of this away. But Doug Clegg, if you get a chance to, you might enjoy seeing it. I think it there was something intriguing about it. I don't know if you heard much about the movie. It was made on about a $15,000 budget.
Wow.
They shot it mostly with high-def video and then transferred it to film. It was shot using the kind of mockumentary style that you might associate with the Blair Witch Project. In fact, there's, I think, a couple of similarities with Blair Witch. But it was that idea of taking what would have been a weakness in the conveyance of the story, that being that they had no money to use to tell the story, and to turn that into a strength, like Night of the Living Dead, the original version, which ends up feeling like a documentary because it's shot on this, you know, these low budget black and white cameras with bad sound. And you really get this feeling like you're really there. And it was kind of the same thing here with Paranormal Activity. And I think that's the lesson. There's a lot of folks out there that want to become movie makers. And I think if we look at the success of low to no budget movies, you have, you know, Blair Witch Project, you have Paranormal Activity, you have the movie Open Water about the couple that was lost to sharks. And right. And I think that there's that's the way to go. If you have no money to tell a story, tell a horror story. And if you and you don't have to have big monsters actually appearing on the screen to scare people. It doesn't take much to scare people. And I think that that's also the lesson from Paranormal Activity. They, you know, they don't have any they didn't do any CGI. This movie, they didn't have any budget for CGI. So they have to do what you can. And I think that's kind of a good thing for any horror writer is to realize that it can just be the air that blows over the back of your neck. You don't have to see the beast that's blowing it.
Absolutely. You know, that's interesting you said that. One of my favorite horror movies from, I believe, the 60s is called Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
I don't know that movie.
Oh, it's one of those movies where the scariest thing comes at near the end. But, again, no special effects. It's purely the actors, the script, a certain setting. And what's terrifying at the end is you realize what you didn't notice before. And it's just, it's a wonderful movie. It's a wonderful movie. It's a little slow for modern audiences who want these sort of shoot 'em up, CGI fest. But what you're describing, I completely believe, which is my favorite movies, especially in horror science fiction, are where they use the limitations of the budget to create a more imaginative look.
Right, which is very Lovecraft, right? I mean, the idea of not what you see, but what you don't see.
But what you don't see, absolutely. And sometimes the big budget movies begin to look like a little too cartoony because the CGI is too perfect. And it can be beautiful, but there's something about limiting where the eye goes, limiting what we see, that becomes very scary. And I completely agree with you on that. So I'm looking forward to seeing Paranormal Activity.
Did you ever see Cloverfield?
I still haven't seen it. I want to. Everyone's recommended it.
Well, it's interesting.
It's the shaky camera issue that I'm slow to adapt to.
Right. And there's a little of that, too, in Paranormal Activity. But that was, this is the J.J. Abrams version of Godzilla. But I think the one thing they did, and even though that was a bigger budget movie, obviously, I really do like the way that so much of what happens just out of frame for right. most of the movie. And you just get a glimpse, and it's like you want to see more, but then at the same time you don't. And it's a great tension that they have there in the way in which that story is told. And I think that's, you know, that's the mistake for a lot of, maybe that's why horror doesn't work for me very often, is they do keep the monster out of the first reel in the movie right. tradition, but then he's in every reel after that.
Right. It's interesting because the first Alien movie, you do not see much of that alien for a long time. And when you finally do, it's like Paris Hilton. I mean, essentially, you know,
right.
It's a
get rid of them.
Creature, and it's scary looking, but it's gorgeous. But gorgeous is not gorgeous in a horrifying way, but that not seeing it, just seeing its tail or seeing the claw or seeing sort of the drool coming off of it, those things are much more terrifying than actually seeing the entire picture. And I think when horror does that, as good as it is, it goes closer, more into fantasy at that point. Once you see the monster fully, you're now in the area of the fantastic rather than the horrifying, which really is horror is really a reaction to things.
I jumped in there when you said Paris Hilton, because I thought you meant then after that, we can't get rid of them. Then after that, the once the monster appears, that's it. And then they're everywhere. It's like,
exactly. Exactly. Well, that's true, too.
So what are the elements? And people coming up, hopefully are going to tell their true stories when we do our annual Ghost to Ghost show. But if you, as a horror fiction writer, had to give somebody some tips on telling a good story, what would those tips be?
Well, the first tip I'd give, and I got to tell you, this is after 20 years of writing for a living, is you want to begin as close to the mistake that the person makes in the story.
I love that. Love that.
As close to whatever that mistake is, you step over a boundary, you go in the house, you're not supposed to put them right on that doorstep at the opening, because we need to launch into it. And I think one of the reasons for that is psychologically, we live vicariously through other people's mistakes and their freedoms. And so when someone, you know, when we say, don't be an idiot, don't go in that house, we really are happy to see them go in because we want to see that experience without having to do it ourselves. And you begin a story as close to that as you can, because then it moves very quickly. People are very involved because they want to see where the second step comes in. So I think too much of an introduction, and I've certainly been guilty of this when I was younger, but I'm not anymore, which is you just need to get right in there, right to where the first boundary is crossed.
Well, I love that, and I want to amplify that, too. That also makes for a great talk radio phone call in general. People believe in preambles, and an introduction to the first chapter of what they're going to say, and I think they forget that until it's too late, that sometimes, you know, if you take too much time in the preamble, you'll never get to what it is that you were going to call about, and then you'll be frustrated. And so, yeah, go right to the part. Start as close to the meat as possible.
Right. And, you know, that's interesting because, you know, we have the Constitution. That preamble trips everyone up in the Constitution. And I think that a preamble, actually, you're absolutely right. With my current book, Isis, which is out there in the stores now, which is a tale of the supernatural, although the story itself is going to take a while to get back to the supernatural, I open with the boundary. I open with the hint of what the boundary is and how the woman in the story will cross it. And I think that there are ways to do that. You know, there are ways to open with a boundary and then go back if you need to later on.
Right.
So I think in a story, it's always best to start right when somebody trips. I mean, you know, it's interesting. Every story that I love that I can think of, and I even mean The Wizard of Oz, you know, in The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy running away from home is her trip. She trips up. She does what a child is not supposed to do. And in doing that, the story launches.
I love that. I love that in context of what your story about Isis, about bringing people back from the dead.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, and I want to get back to that, but I mean, I can totally see how you relate to that. All right. So that's the first element, is start just before the mistake that is made in the story that you're going to tell. What else? Another good tip for people to be keeping in mind when they call in with their real ghost stories coming up on Halloween night.
I think to eliminate the side detail that doesn't really matter, focus on the details that led to the experience. If your aunt happened to call you that day and she's not the ghost, you might leave her out of it.
Right.
You know, just really stick with, get as close to whatever that experience is as possible. And I think to bring your emotion into it. I think bringing the emotion of how you felt, what that experience meant to you, is probably the biggest thing I'd suggest. It's not just an experience, it's how you experienced it.
With that in mind, I want to share an email from a guy named Jack, who wrote last week sharing the story of a guy he works with who used to be a guy who worked at the Field Museum in Chicago. Ever been to the Field Museum in Chicago?
No, but I want to go now.
It's very cool, and it's huge, and it's one of those great cavernous museums where there's a bunch of just a million old exhibits going back to the 20s and 30s of those great, you know, dioramas and all that other stuff. Anyway, he was working there, and he was down in one of their exhibition halls, and he called his boss, who said, hey, you might want to notify somebody that we've got a cat running around down here. And the boss said something like, did it have a crooked tail? And he said, yeah, that's the one. You know about it? And he said, yeah, do me a favor and tell, you know, so-and-so, and he'll take care of it. So this guy talked to another guy who said it was a black cat with a crooked tail. And they said, yeah, we know about it. That's a ghost cat.
Oh, it's nice.
It's been seen for years. Black cat with a crooked tail. And everybody who comes to work at the museum at one point or another sees that.
Wow.
And I think that's, I just love that idea. It doesn't have to be much to kind of give you the little, you know, goosebumpy feeling, but that there could be a ghost cat running around the Field Museum. Nobody puts any food out for it, but it's just there creeping in between the late night exhibits.
And the creepy thing about that is museums really are monuments to to death. In other words, they're beautiful, but they're the past. There's some, or there's some other culture. They're very creepy in their own beautiful way. You know, museum.
Right. Yeah,
and so that's even more interesting that there's a cat haunting the haunted.
And in a way, they're all about capturing the undead, aren't they?
Right.
I mean,
you're exactly right. That's exactly what it is.
It's sort of like frozen zombie exhibits.
Exactly. But they just don't want brains, so they're okay. You know, when I was a kid, I thought museums were forests of the dead because I'd go through as a kid and I'd go through those exhibits where there's stuffed animals. And, you know, those exhibits, and you see the seagulls, like the 20 different kinds of seagulls from the coast or whatever. And then you get in, and they'd have the indigenous people exhibit. And I thought, were those people stuffed too?
Right. Exactly.
Because I did see Planet of the Apes as a kid, and I know the apes stuffed some of us. But I don't know if people did that too.
Why not? And why? That's actually a very logical thought. That's something fantastic.
That's what I thought as a kid. I thought that was very creepy as a kid to go to the museum at times.
And do we know that they didn't?
I only live on faith with that. It's my denial again. I don't want to find out.
I'm really serious. I wonder whether there's ever a time at any museum when they did. I mean,
speaking of all these topics, there is one place that I've been to. A lot of people have been to if they ever travel the 10 freeway in Arizona. I based an entire story or book on this. There's a place called The Thing. Have you ever heard of this?
Well, other than the movie The Thing?
No. This is a gas station emporium curio thing, roadside attraction. And it's been there for years and years and years. And you go in, you pay 75 cents. It might be a little more now. This was like 10 years ago. You go in, you pay your money. You go down these long sort of Quonset hut kind of hallways out off to the desert. And you end up trying to figure out what the thing is. And you go into this room and you see it. And I'm not going to tell you what it is because I don't want to spoil the 75 cent ride if you ever go there. But on the way, it's even creepier. Because there's a torture chamber made with, you know, out of the stumps of wood, someone carved, like chainsaw carved, like women being beaten. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
And then there's like a Nazi car. And I asked the people who ran it, I said, did you guys put this together? And they said, no, we bought it from someone who bought it from someone else. It's been here for like 35 years or something. And it's creepier because you think, who put this together?
Right.
The Nazi car, women being whipped in a medieval torture chamber carved out of tree stumps, and then you get to what the thing is, and it's again back to your question about do you think they actually kind of might have stuffed people the way they do the animals?
Right.
You got to see this exhibit.
But that brings me back then to you as a horror fiction writer. Is how I mean I've heard this said before that when you're writing fiction, you actually have to stick to the credible more than somebody who's writing history. History happened, so you just recount what happened and then you kind of put all your cards up on the table. But then when you're writing fiction, especially horror fiction, there's a greater onus on you as a writer to make it believable, which in a way limits what you can do.
Well, limited, but it's also, again, back to using the limitations to create something. I think limitations actually help someone who's writing or creating art or movies or whatever, that the limitation allows their imagination to say, okay, how can I make this work? How can I make this credible? So when I was writing Isis, it's set in the 19th century. How do I make that even credible? And how do I make it credible, the death in the story? How do I make it credible, her going to the tombs and learning to talk to the dead? And what I really had to do was, you get emotionally inside the character. You get emotionally inside the story, because it's the emotions that make it real for people. You get, if a reader identifies with the person going through this, this is, again, back to your ghost-to-ghost thing. If the person writing brings their emotion, their feeling into it, I think in general that will sort of amplify the truth of it, because I think most of our reality is subjective. It is inside our heads. We don't know what we see. Again, back to the farmer in the house that my mother saw and I saw, we weren't sure what we saw. We kind of knew what we saw, but we never saw it so solidly we could completely define it. But it was in our heads, and we had an emotional response to it, which is really why we didn't talk about it, because, you know, then we would have to go into these subjects of that my mother and I probably didn't want to talk about in her lifetime, which was, you know, life, death, spirituality, all the things
right.
we didn't talk about.
Probably to some degree, too, with moms like that, probably even sex.
Welcome to my life.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was guessing at that, but those things all start getting wrapped up, which are essentially all of the things that define who we are. Right? Sexuality, yeah, spirituality, exactly. Personality. So if you can have the exact same ghost experience and you can't talk about that, then once more, isn't that where the ultimate purpose of writing horror fiction
right.
it serves? It gives people a launching off point for conversations and for exploration of things that otherwise people are not really allowed to talk about in their families.
Right, and you're exactly right, and so when I'm writing supernatural stories, which I really love, my life has been, even in my suspense fiction, supernatural stories. There's always a tinge of the supernatural, if not an outright supernatural, and I think that you're actually hitting a better nail on the head than I have. I think you've gotten to the core of it, which is, it's being able to talk about things that people aren't always comfortable talking about. It's being able to explore something imaginatively, and the reader does this too. That we don't always like in the, you know, we want to pretend we're rational. And I think part of the supernatural is the irrational. It's what we don't know. It's what we can't figure out. It's what we can't really talk about with the people who might be closest to us.
Well, you know, coming up, I'm going to take some phone calls here in the last hour. Maybe the last half hour. I'm not sure on what yet. Because I you know what, there's part of me wants to try a little experiment. But it'll take a minute for me to describe that experiment. So I'm going to wait till after the top of the hour till I tell you what I think would be an interesting way for others to jump in on this conversation. And we'll do that with Douglas Clegg, the author of the supernatural book Isis. You can link up to him and all of his works through coasttocoastam.com. If you don't know Doug Clegg yet, you will. He's a rising star, already established, obviously a multi-award-winning author, but at the same time still growing in popularity. And hopefully we're going to help a little bit with that tonight, too. So stand by. You want to participate in a little live horror phone experiment? We'll get to that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.